6 o'clock. The work session is now in order, so first thing we do is the roll call, so Rolio is here.
Heffelman's here today.
Rankin is here.
Berman's here.
East is here.
Updike's here.
Missing is Mrs. Blom, who's celebrating in San Diego for a grandchild. Good for her.
No Dustin?
No.
No, he's
Dustin. No Dustin.
He's off on vacation.
Greg hasn't been here in a while, has he?
No.
I see him periodically. He says, I'm going to come back. But.
Okay, so. New business. First item number 2A. A discussion over the implementation steps for SB 1537, the governor's housing bill. Mr. Director.
Thank you. Derek Tuggles, Community Development Department. The governor's housing bill was passed, will be signed into law, and it will become effective in early June. And so the purpose of this work session is going to go through. And I want to basically compare, I included a comparison between the governor's housing bill on the adjustments piece. There are a lot of other things in the bill, but on the adjustments piece, the difference between that and what's now ordinance 2222, which is a draft ordinance that the city council will be considering at their next meeting. You saw that, made a recommendation for adoption on that. Part of this is to get a sense of where you're at in terms of what your principal concerns, if any, are with what's in the governor's bill. Because if you have concerns about certain provisions, there are some steps we may be able to take to disincentivize developers from pursuing those paths. If you're not concerned about them, then there's no need for us to take those steps. We'll be having the same conversation with the city council in a work session on the 18th. And then from there, I have some funds for legal analysis above and beyond our city attorney. David and I coordinate when it's appropriate to do that. In this case, we're going to use the local government law group out of Eugene to provide some guidance on a few of these provisions. There's some confusing stuff in here, too, where they didn't quite get the pieces lined up, I think, appropriately, specifically with respect to limited land use decisions, where they have some conflicting language that were to apply it one way, and then later in the bill it says, no, we're to apply it a different way. And so we're going to have to figure out, well, which way are we supposed to do this? Just so you know, limited land use decisions are an alternate land use decision-making process. Local governments are not obligated to generally have them, although that's the direction this bill goes, that we have to actually use it. Our type 2 review process is very similar to a limited land use process, and so we've just used that. Limited land use process has a more limited notification area. It's only 100 feet. We provide more than that. But if we're mandated to use this, then we're going to have its specific provisions. And that's part of the, you know, how tight are some of these mandates from the governor's office. That's kind of some of the back and forth we'll have with the local government law group. Another area, if you're inclined to go down, which has to do with fees, we need to be careful when we play around with fees. Generally, we're limited to just recovering costs, but that's in the context of it being land use fees. Do we have to necessarily characterize them as land use fees? There may be some play there. But again, that's where you get legal counsel involved, because we want to make sure we're on decent footing. And frankly, we don't want to, I don't think we want to convey the message that we're thumbing our nose to the governor's office efforts, the efforts of the legislature, because they're trying to move the dial with housing, as are we. And as we've made a point in our testimony to them, in our council's testimony in opposition to the adjustments, is, hey, look, we've been doing this fairly well for some time now, and we're making progress. Don't force this on us. It fell on deaf ears. governor's looking at a much larger playing field with lots of other jurisdictions and lots of other issues in those jurisdictions. So they may have other things on their mind, certainly more than a community of our size, given the housing issues in the state and some of the larger municipalities. So anyway, but we're gonna have to square with it and deal with it, and this is kind of, this work session is intended to, I really just want to get your feedback as we move forward through this as to what parts of the governor's adjustment piece are giving you heartburn, if any. So I thought I'd go through the comparison chart.
What flexibility are they when they have mandate from the legislature?
I mean, in your memo, you talked about, you know, design review in the 9 Beach or the Bayfront area.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you speak into the mic? Can't hear you when you're facing.
There we go. Is that on?
Mm-hmm. It should be turned.
My question is we have a law that's been mandated by the legislature. It's been signed into law by our governor, and I'm wondering how much flexibility we as a small community have to vary from the mandate from the legislature. And I recall that in the memo that that Derek sent us, he had a couple of concerns, one of which was design review, say, in the Nye Beach area. And we know that the folks who live in Nye Beach, they're pretty advocated in terms of, you know, wanting to maintain their style down there, similarly along the Bayfront. So my question basically to Derek was, how much flexibility does this small municipality have to vary the mandate from the legislature, number one? And then the other question, going back to the eligibility issue, on a typical 100 by 50-foot lot, how many of those would fit into an acre? Because you're talking about density must be 6 units per acre. And how does that really change what we're doing now?
Okay, I'm going to take them in turn. The way this home rule works, and we're a home rule city, and the way home rule works, and the league actually put a nice handout out on that for local governments, League of Oregon Cities, is if the state has explicit language that says we have to do something exactly a certain way, then we are bound by that and have to do it exactly that way. If the state isn't that explicit or doesn't speak to it at all, then we're free to implement it as we interpret it. You'll find that not everything here is tight to the T. There is room for interpretation in certain areas that we, and I'll touch on them as we go through this chart. So if the state says you have to do A, you know, and it's very explicit, then we have to do A. But when we go through here, you'll often see, you know, they say we have to do A, but they don't say we can't charge a fee for it. And we typically can control that. In try to say, well, you know, I think the expectation is that we charge a fee for anything that's a limited land use decision. They didn't say we couldn't, so we can. So fees are fair game. Fees can be structured in a way that, you know, they can be a disincentive for somebody or not. Those are things we can talk about. As to your question about density, I mean, we are generally over 6 units to the acre. 6 units to the acre would be about 7,200 square foot lot, if I did my math right, in that ballpark. You know, so our R1, we're going to have some stuff that's below that, but outside of that, we're generally well above that. And the last subdivision we did in Wilder was closing in on about 14 units to the acre, so more than twice that. I think our average density in Newport, I think looking back on housing studies, is a little over 6 units to the acre, average. And that's probably bumped up since I last looked at it. So anyway, real quick, looking at the scope. So the scope of the government's housing bill, this is the comparison chart. It applies to net new housing units, so if somebody's renovating a house, they don't get to take care of the adjustments. That's not a new housing unit. You know, if they're replacing a house, they don't get to take advantage of it. That's, again, not net new housing units. So the governor's adjustment package is net new housing units.
So what does the term net mean there? Why didn't it just say new housing?
Good question. I don't know why they chose to use it. That's what they said. I don't know, net versus gross housing. I'm not sure. I mean, I think they were just trying to emphasize that it means okay, if you're removing two and you're adding three, you net one new housing unit. The others are just replacement units. Maybe that's what they were getting at. It was their term. I just used it. The point is, it has to result in new housing units for it to be eligible to go down that adjustment path.
And that includes ADUs?
Yes, that's a dwelling unit. So if you're doing an ADU, that would be a net new housing unit. That's a fair question. The ordinance we're working at, all development types. So it's more flexible. I mean, we didn't specify that it had to be net new housing, and really in the context of a code, it doesn't make a lot of sense. If you're gonna make a 10% adjustment available for housing, why wouldn't you make it available to other? Our reasoning supports it being available to all development types. They limit it to 10 adjustments. We don't specify a limit.
How many adjustments are possible on a typical, say, triplex?
It's unlikely you'd have, well, if you get in, I think they put it at 10 because of design components. I mean, when you start putting in windows and roof pitches, I'll use Night Beach as an example, you can get into at least a half a dozen just there before you even get into side setbacks, building coverage, landscaping requirements, height limitations. So if you're diving into design, and you couple that with the other types of basically built form standards, you could get over 10.
Most, I recall, is 3 we had with the hotel.
We don't get a lot of requests for those. Most folks look to try to develop within. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, will this change a dynamic for people approaching development in communities, not just ours, but statewide? Will they be less inclined to try to tailor their development to meet local development standards? I don't have an answer for that. So, what I do know is this will be well known to the development community. The home builders will make sure this is out there. They'll know it's an available option if they want to pursue it. So, eligibility, and this is one area where we would pose a question to legal counsel. The way it's structured, they have to state that, look, to be eligible for an adjustment, they have to state that that's going to lead to less costly housing, more timely housing. It will lead to a reduced sales price or reduced rental prices, or it's going to be affordable units, or the adjustment relates to improving accessibility. Can we make them show their work? My suspicion is the response is going to be within limits, that we're not going to be able to require a whole lot on that front. That was pushed when the governor's office was putting this together. Cities asked for, hey, no, this, they need to be able to demonstrate this, not just check a box on a form that says it fits in this box. Well, why? How? How's it, you know, resulting in these things?
So something I'd like to note that California is dealing with, so there's the Builder's Remedy Law, which allows a builder to move forward with housing development and avoid almost all local regulations. Just build it. Lots of incentives at the state level. And the issue there was the same. Well, the intent was to create more affordable housing.
Right.
What's happening in reality, because of the pricing challenges to make a deal pencil, developers are using Builder's Remedy to reduce their proposed density of projects. They're coming in for replats of less units, saying, in accordance with this, if we weren't able to do that, we won't build anything. So you want zero or you want four units instead of the 11 that I have entitled. So it's an interesting dynamic during a difficult economy for a developer, where they're using the loopholes here that I see the same loophole in the Oregon law.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
To say I wouldn't have a project but for this. Therefore, it qualifies, and I'm going to take advantage of it. It'll be interesting to see if that comes out in any degree. Maybe not here, but perhaps in the metros.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Bob.
When we did one of those incentives, we said, okay, we're going to hire, I guess, a forensic accounting firm or something equivalent to certify that those criteria were met. Is there anything similar here that would apply to where you say, how much can we ask them to prove?
I can certainly ask that of legal counsel. I suspect the answer is going to be no. But it's you know, get the answer. I mean, there's no harm. But yeah, to have a third party take a look at it, or I don't think we can go a peer review route with the developers. But I mean, that's fair.
I mean, it just seems like some kind of objective way to decide whether yes, they really have basis.
You think the staff could be coached up to learn those issues?
I don't think there's enough time. Obviously, they can learn, but I don't think that's enough time available in the planning.
Well, we always hear that the staff's overburdened as you are.
Well, I think if somebody's just simply checking a box, I mean that, and then you put the burden on a city staff to refute that. We have no information really to work with. You know, I mean, that's the challenge. It's less costly. Why? You know, what are you relying on? What's your argument? You know, unless we can get something material out of them, there's not much we can do with it other than confirm that they checked the box. With respect to what you were talking about, Bob, has to do with the multiple unit property tax exemption, and that's where we have a third party review the financials. And there are a number of qualified, you know, firms that can do that kind of work. And it worked well for us for Surfview Village to have somebody else take a look at it. And what it does is it adds a degree of transparency to the government process. So if somebody were to say, why'd you do this $1.6 million giveaway to this affordable housing project, you can point back to, hey, loan, the financials showed that this project would not have penciled out if not for that subsidy. So the subsidy was justified. So in those cases, I think it's very important to have a third party, you know, who's not a city staffer or a policymaker, take a hard look at that stuff. For us, for housing, it's additional units. That's where we went in. Not less costly, not more timely, additional units. Decision type, this is an area where we're actually more lenient, which would be more attractive for some. Ministerial is over the counter. There's no process. There's no notice. There's no risk of denial. I mean, you meet the standard, you meet it, you move forward. Fees, on a ministerial, we wouldn't really impose a fee. That's part of our operating expenses. We pick up fees with building permit review, but we don't have a set planning review fee. We could impose one, and that would apply to anything we review for compliance with clear and objective planning standards, but right now we don't.
Do you have the funds to do a fee study?
You know, last time the city did a fee study was in 2009, so it's been a while. And it would have to be something programmed, and I suspect the city would want to do it citywide, not just land use. Because we have quite a few other fees that the city has, so you on the budget committee will be looking at the fee schedule.
Do you think that kind of fee is a good idea?
That what?
A review fee, community development review fee.
You know, a modest one, yeah, that'd probably be fine.
You're going to put that in the budget?
I'll think about it. I've got other fees I'm working on the building side, but which that program has to be fee supported, whereas planning is intentionally not. Now, fees provide a portion of the cost, but the perspective with planning is that there's a broader public benefit from the application of these rules. It's not just the developer that's benefiting, and therefore they should bear 100% of the cost on the planning side, whereas they bear 100% of the cost on the building side. That's one area. When we get into to some of the other on the fees, again, that's one area that we could look at disincentivizing certain aspects of the governor's bill if you feel that that's appropriate. The governor's bill sunsets. So eventually it will go away unless reauthorized by the legislature. But the sunset's quite a ways out there at 2032. So I would advise it's appropriate for us. If the sunset was only out, a couple of years, a few years, maybe we don't even codify anything, but out to 2032, we probably want to codify something too in terms of how we implement it.
Would you consider sunsetting your revised ordinance to the same sunset as the state law?
No, I think what we've worked on is better, and so it doesn't warrant that. I mean, you can always repeal it or elements of it if they're not working well. The problem with sunsets, which I don't love, is it forces us to review stuff even if it's working well. And we have plenty of things on our plate. So yanking something back up that's working, but we have to because it's about to sunset, kind of sets, extra work for us down the road. So with respect to the adjustments, so the governor's, it's 10% to side or rear. Ours is front, rear, side. Landscaping, ours is 10%, but we don't have a landscaping requirement for single family detached or attached. Governor's is 25%.
Derek, can I go back to the overall context here?
Yeah.
Our ordinance is based on granting adjustments to incentivize developers to actually do the development. In other words, they got it.
Right.
Yeah. Is that the same as this? I mean, I thought we said, well, we'll give you this adjustment if you can show that you're going to add one unit, if you get that adjustment, or the height thing. So if you're going to be able to add that third story because we're going to let you build a little higher.
Ours does, the governor's does not.
So the governor's applies flat out to all new construction.
To new housing. One of the principal arguments made by the league was that there is no guarantee we're going to get more affordable housing out of this at all. So.
Justin would say more doors are good no matter who.
I would say it too. I said the more units we have, the better off we are. And that's going to influence, rental rates and, the sale prices for homes in a positive direction if you have more units out there. You're going to get more affordability. It's just supply and demand. But,
Derek?
Yeah.
Does the governor's bill cover all housing or just middle housing?
All housing. Yep.
Okay.
All housing.
Okay.
The total waiver of parking minimums, whereas we have a one-to-one credit option where parking exists on both sides of the street. And in fact, if that's an area that gives you heartburn, one area that we can go is say, look, you don't get, and this would require a code amendment, but you don't get to do those narrow street standards if you're going to be asking for relief from off-street parking. Because those narrow street standards were designed to reduce your costs on the street construction, and they do not have provisions for on-street parking. And so you're going to have to do full street sections on your frontage to create on-street parking if you're, doing new street work, if you want to take advantage of something like that. And it's totally reasonable.
That sounds like something we're going to do.
Okay. I thought you would, so.
Oh, yes.
You know, it's unfortunate. You go through the effort to create skinny street standards, and then you get this, that mandates this. And, you know, the league was very, very clear. I mean, what frustrates me is they make assumptions in Salem that we have the same kind of transit service that Portland has, that we have the same kind of pedestrian and cycling amenities that Eugene has, or in these larger communities that are much more well-resourced than we are. And we don't. Our transit service is not what Portland's is. We don't have the kind of ped and bike amenities, you know, in a built environment where we have ample amount of housing that's within walking distance of the places of employment. We don't have that. And yeah, that's where total waiver of your off-street parking. I get it. Off-street parking is expensive. It adds a lot to the price of housing. But we're out here in a rural area where people have to rely on their vehicles more, in a terrain-constrained area where our roads are much narrower in many cases than what you find in a lot of the valley communities, with roads, existing roads that lack off, you know, parking because it was expensive enough just to get it in with the terrain they're dealing with. It's not apples to apples. And, you know, you can rely on a developer to, and most developers would go ahead and put the off-street parking in because they know they need it to make it a marketable product in our area. But unfortunately, more often than not, these codes are really designed to address the odd developer, you know, who comes in and makes the bad choice. And now we've got people cramming in on very narrow streets that weren't designed for that kind of parking. Minimum lot size, 10% deviation from the governor for size, width, depth. We're kind of in the same boat the way we have it structured. Same with maximum lot size. Same with building coverage. They have a whole lot in bike parking that we don't really delve into. Again, it's just not something the city's regulated in the same manner. Building height. They recognize that some cities regulate by story, and they actually explicitly put in their zoning code story, you know, 1, 2, 3-story, 4-story, whatever. And others, it's more of a fixed building height, which is how ours is done, which is common as well. So they're on 1-story or 20% of the base zone limit. The increase to 40 feet, you know, is short of that, but probably more than sufficient in most cases for the multifamily. I think the trouble we're going to potentially run into with building height under the governor's is view amenities.
Is what?
View amenities. The desire from, say, a condo developer to get that additional height to improve the view of a bay or the ocean. And they can do that through here, from what I can see. And we cautioned, a lot of jurisdictions cautioned the governor's office on that, that the power of view amenities is strong. And it's not just coastal communities, you have them everywhere. That the value to real estate that's associated with a view amenity is pretty significant, and you're gonna see people do this just to improve views. So
they'll be limited to 48 feet, 20% of the base zone. If the zone is 40, if our zone is 40 feet for the view, they can go to 48 feet, right?
They could go full 20% up.
Right. But they can't exceed that.
No.
Unless there's a conditional use permit for some reason.
But that's been stereo.
Well, I mean, here's a silly question. Why, if we're talking about a percentage, why can't we just lower our numbers? So that when you add the 20%, it comes right back to where we would have been anyway.
that would force them to do the, that would force them basically do, to do adjustments to get to you know, what is
already. They're all going to do it anyway, aren't they?
I don't know.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. If we have an alternate path that's more attractive to them, I think they'll do the alternate path.
I don't think away time and risk. Yeah. Right?
There's no risk. That's all they have to do is ask for.
Now, that's a ministerial on this side, but that's a limited land use on the other side.
Yeah.
So if you want to go for that extra few percentage points and roll the dice, would you?
What is the roll of the dice, exactly? There's no notice. Nobody's going to know they're doing it.
Yeah, there's notice with a limited land use decision. It's not.
One point says no notice. The other one says 100 feet.
Well, that's where they're messed. That's where they've gotten messed up, and we need
right.
Some help. Because not only does the other place say it has to be 100 feet, but then it says they added language in the bill that says local governments shall use the specific language in this section.
Yeah.
Which then I'm like, okay, my brain's blowing up. All right, we're supposed to use this specific language, which is explicit about providing notice to neighbors, but then in this other section of the bill, you say you can do it and only provide notice to the applicant.
But in either case, what
I don't
is
know what the lawyer's going to say, provide the notice to the neighbors.
No, sure. And probably provide it 200 feet, which is what we do anyway. We can always go greater than that 100 feet, I assume.
I'm not certain of that, based how they drafted this latest amended language.
If we
could do more than that, then we don't even need to do a limited land use decision. Our Type 2 process covers everything that's in there. But they put some goofy language in there.
But what is this risk that John mentioned? What is the risk of going through the state process here? In what case could it fail?
We could deny an adjustment because we don't believe it's an eligible project. We have that authority. We'd have to be able to probably show our work.
What is that? What would make it ineligible?
What would make it ineligible? Okay, no net housing units, that's one. We don't believe that it's gonna make it less costly. We don't believe that it influenced the timing of the house. We don't believe that it's gonna have any influence over the sales price or rental price, you know, at the end of the day. There are also some other provisions in here that talk about, you know, that talk about, you know, it doesn't alleviate the requirement for meeting safety codes, you know, so we may be pulling in those codes to knock it out. There's also a provision in there that talks about it. This doesn't apply to shoreline areas. Well, how broadly can we interpret that? Maybe we can include the entire mapped shoreline area, not just the natural resources, which our code is designed to protect along the shoreline. They weren't explicit about that. They just said it doesn't apply to coastal shoreline areas. Okay, maybe we get to view that as expansive as possible, which would pick up the better part of Night Beach and the entire bayfront. Because the bayfront's all within a shoreline comp plan designation. That's why we have W1 and W2. Okay, you know, so Bayfront's out, and then about half of Night Beach, maybe a little bit more, falls within the shoreline boundaries. So you say no, you're not eligible because you're inside the boundaries of the shoreline overlay. I mean, there are risks involved with any discretionary decision, and a limited land use process is designed for discretionary land use decisions.
Okay.
I wouldn't say high risk, but it's risk.
No, it's not. All right. By the way, you probably knew I was going to say this. Those shoreline maps really need to be redone by the GIS guy. Do we have a GIS guy now?
We do have a GIS person.
Okay. Can you make a note?
We actually probably need to, well, we need to legislatively adopt the new boundaries because whatever that line is likely to be slightly different than whatever those old cartoonish maps showed.
Well, those are basically unusable, and so it would be nice to have some real technical true status?
Unit density maximums, they basically say that just kind of how the chips fall with all the other adjustments is basically how they structure the business. So if somebody's looking for minimum lot size reductions and various, you know, that would give them a little bit more density, then that's what it's going to be. They didn't try to peg it as part of their adjustment process. Ours allows 10%. It's the same 10% provision. Mixed use prohibition on the ground floor for residential. They say we must allow ground floor residential except one face of the building that faces the street and is within 20 feet of the street. I don't ask me why it's that explicit.
Somebody had a project somewhere, and that's why that ended up here.
Mixed use prohibition of ground floor, non-residential, they get into that too, must allow certain non-residential activities, like daycare, live workspace. That's really not an issue for us. Design standards. Now, we adopted some new ones as part of the HB 2001. So we have design standards for townhouses and cottage clusters. I haven't really put those to the test yet, so we don't know, you know, if anybody's going to necessarily have issues with those. The ones that certainly would be of most concern would be the Nine Beach design standards, because that's the most mature set of design standards we have. We have a track record with those. I mean, they would allow you basically facade materials, color pattern, facade articulation, roof forms, materials. I mean, much of what's in the design standard package that we have in Fernai Beach would be waivable through their adjustment process.
What would historical designations for neighborhoods do to the state law?
Nothing.
Have to abide by the state law.
Yeah, no, you had advocates for historic preservation try to get those changes and were not successful. The prevailing perspective that I'd heard from a number of folks is that the governor's office views historic preservation as basically protecting homes for the wealthy. That a lot of the historic preservation, there's background to support that in many cases where historic preservation has rules have ensured high-end housing for people who can afford it because of the value of homes in those historic districts, mm-hmm. and that those protect that value and have in the result kind of wall out folks, you know, with less means. So they didn't get a sympathetic ear from the governor's office.
Well, I was just curious. I mean, I come from a community that had many historical neighborhoods, and it was that ended up to me to be very heavy-handed. If you wanted to do something with the outside of your house, you couldn't use, modern-day materials that look just like historical materials were not allowed. So you're asking someone to put wood siding on a house when there's many other materials, and of course a wood house has a much higher maintenance cost. It seemed to be unfair to some residents in the historical district who would now be forced, at least in the climate that existed, would have to be painting and doing the cost of painting their house every 4 years. That's a heavy cost to most landowners, most property owners. I have a question for our attorney sitting to my right.
Mr. Allen's not here.
I'm talking about Braulio Escobar. I was reading through this monstrosity, and I came across this line, and you're even welcome to read it. And they're talking about when a developer willfully made false statements. So my question is, what is the standard in the court to prove willful action? How would a city do that with a developer to prove that they were willfully hiding or presenting false material versus just making a mistake?
Well, in a typical civil proceeding, it's preponderance of the evidence, just kind of weigh things. And, you know, which side does the scale of justice fall? In a criminal case, you've got that standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, so you want to be doggone certain if you're convicting someone. There's a middle level in there called clear and convincing. So I would think that if the standard were to hold someone accountable under willful, I think you'd want to use that higher standard of clear and convincing, you know, very strong evidence.
Which makes it very hard, which would make it very difficult.
It would, yes. And going to court always makes things difficult, you know. There's people like me who want to twist words.
Yes, well, that's why I found the word willfully to be a very dangerous word.
You know, I wasn't present when they were putting together this, but there's always, like you were mentioning, give and take. Well, let's slip this on here because I've got a friend who's putting up a development, you know. So we have to live with it until 2032. The governor put her reputation behind this. Now we have it.
Your opinion?
Sorry.
No,
back to the design standards here, Derek.
Yes.
What would be your recommendation for how we can protect the 9H design standards, if there's any way to do it?
My concern is design standards would be the ones that would get attacked because facade, the requirements we have there. You could see somebody coming in trying to make an argument that, well, those are all, I mean, there's always a cost factor associated with some of the material requirements we have in 9BH. I would try to get at it through potentially the shoreline designation, at least for a portion. I included in here, it's an interesting concept, but it's if you have a mixed-use development where at least 26% of the finished area is non-residential, then they don't qualify. And I know we've had a number of discussions in NYBH about trying to get live-work environments going. That might be worth a discussion with the 9Neighbors, particularly in the C2 designated areas, you know. Is do you want to put in a requirement that basically says you have to have 26% of your finished area available for non-residential use, in which case they would then not be able to take advantage of the design adjustments? I'm trying to put what options I can out there.
No, I think that's good. Is this one where we could say, if you ask for that, you are ineligible for all our other programs?
Yes, that's another one where we can go on. I think I'd put that in the memo. And it's an excellent point, Bob, is we're not obligated to subsidize this behavior. Somebody who's choosing to do something that's inconsistent with the policies the city's developed through engagement with its community, we're not obligated to subsidize that with a property tax exemption. And that's going to be meaningful for any affordable housing project. For an affordable housing project moving forward, they're going to be looking for assistance in addition to whatever up to. So that, and I don't know you'd get pushback from at the state level on something like that. They can't expect that we're going to subsidize it to boot.
Do you think it would be, I mean, what type of outreach do you envision to engage, our NYBH neighbors who are invested in the design standards to have input on the ultimate local ordinance?
Well, it's a good question. I mean, it's...
You send an email to Wendy?
I was thinking more along the lines of just reaching out to the 9Neighbors and actually having a conversation with them. If there are any changes like the one I was just talking about, would they even entertain a change to the code that would require that kind of amount of non-residential space in a dwelling unit. We can also use that opportunity to inform them that here's the package and palette of adjustments. And one of the challenges, unfortunately, is again, they're aware of it. I mean, Jan, our mayor, is the president of the Nine Neighbors. He's, you know, he contributed to that letter and testimony both times. I mean, this isn't the first time. 1537 is just a, you know, was this slightly tweaked version of the governor's bill that was in the long session previously and failed by one vote. So we've known this is out there. Jan's known it's out there. But, you know, the broader Nine Beach community doesn't. And so as we move forward, I think it's worth meeting with them just to inform them about what we're dealing with, what the limitations are. We're not going to be able to stop all of these changes. But here are some things we can do. And
as these things come in, the planning commissioner, we're never even going to know it unless you tell us, right?
Right. And we were not required by the governor's office to track these. They would like it reported, but they didn't go so far as to mandate it. It's in here. I think it's a sensitivity at the state level that they've been hitting cities too hard on mandated reporting. You don't want to know how many times different flavors of reports we have to file. So you're right, Bob. You wouldn't know unless we tallied up and told you. I was just going to touch on one other on the list, which was building height transitional requirements. You know, this is when you have basically a commercial next to residential. We have those transitional requirements. If you have residential units making it a mixed-use project, they'd be able to deviate from those transitional requirements up to 50% under the governor's rules. Remember, that's a height transition and a setback. Those are the two pieces that we have. So I guess my question to you is, what are your thoughts? I mean, are there specific aspects of the governor's proposal that you have concerns with? Are others just fine? My sense is that parking and the design standards would likely be the ones that you'd be most concerned about, but
we'll vote for that.
Yes, and the and the ineligibility for financial incentives if they don't follow our local rules.
Yeah.
You're comfortable with that as kind of a disincentive?
That wasn't our thinking when we set up those programs. How to distribute that money. So I think we should stay true to our word until we're told that we can't stay true to our word, so we can hang on somebody else's back. I think we're pinning tails on donkeys.
So just to sort of, again, take a step back, person's going to do a project,
right?
Develop an apartment house.
Yeah.
They can walk into your office and they can either say, I want all those adjustments I'm entitled to, in which case we may set some other offsetting things, or they can just do the process as it exists right now or would exist if this, whatever
ordinance
passes.
Correct. And the ordinance 2222 is, if it passes, that's all ministerial, so that's all over-the-counter kind of stuff. The governor's would involve a limited land use decision, and we'd be able to set some pricing based on probably on a per-adjustment basis or for the entire review, I don't know.
Okay, so it's up to the developer to choose which path to go down.
Right.
And it's up to us to try and convince them to go down the right path.
I think we've done a reasonably good job of that. I think that's how it's going to play out. I don't think most developers want to knowingly do things that are inconsistent with the community's rules. They want to get along. Most do. Most want to do something that meets our rules and still meets their bottom line.
But, you know, realistically, where in the community is there available buildable land?
Well,
I mean, I can't see a lot of these large developments occurring, even during the sunset term.
But this isn't just large. This is any. This is an ADU could fall into this.
Well, but I could very well see some stuff happening. You know, remember this is an emphasis on middle housing. I could see a small house with a nice view of the bay and torn down and condo development going in.
Doesn't this
that wouldn't be new, would it?
Well, if the condo development has more than one unit, it's 10 units.
Tear one unit down and put four up.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So yeah. Three of them.
With a 20% height bonus so that you can get a better view.
Right.
That's
considered.
That's not the bar here.
Yeah.
That's the challenge. I mean, it's, you know.
Not to beat a dead horse, but San Francisco dealing with the state density bonus that the state crammed down on the cities, allowing an addition of modest amount of affordable housing, giving you an automatic height adjustment without local review, without input from citizens, if you can imagine in a city like that. Suddenly 17, 20, 50 story buildings are being proposed in what used to be single family residential zoning areas. It gets a little crazy, receive just proposals. But. So question for you, Derek, on timing. So we're dealing with some financial incentives. Is there a speed incentive that we could provide a developer, i.e. the state law has maximums for the timing to deliver a decision pursuant to their process? I'm guessing we don't have a Derek is to sit on it for X days. It's whatever the state law would provide. Can we provide an incentive where if you go down the ministerial route,
we're going to act on it faster?
You do it faster? No pressure.
Yeah, that's the hard one for us. No, it's a fair question. I mean, is and typically on the ministerial, what we're dealing with then really are our building plan review timelines, which would be, I'll say for a multifamily, you'd have a 4-week initial review, 8 to 12 weeks total time frame. And I don't know that I can commit. I part of that too is we utilize contract services for plan review in some circumstances. That's much harder for us to be able to say we're gonna do something expedited. I mean, they'll do a one-off for us, but to programmatically, you know, that's hard because they have lots of clients, and to be able to do that, that's tough. My hope is ministerial is better than limited land use, period. I mean, it is. Limited land use does involve a process. Ministerial, you know, it's just, you go right into building plan.
My concern of many is the one where only the applicant would be notified of decisions and they would be the only one that can appeal a decision.
You would like it more broadly to notice neighbors?
Well, I'm a big believer of sunlight laws.
That's fair.
And I, you know, this is just the governor trying to cover things up and make people go away. Let's keep the community out of it. We don't want the neighbors to know what's going on.
That was one of those concerns of engaging our friends and neighbors, because then anything comes up and involves them, then they show up with an opinion.
Well, yes, and they should. I mean, yeah. I rely on the citizens to have a voice. That's what we're here for, including our own voices here. But clearly, the governor doesn't want us to have a voice. Tremont Hurt.
With all due respect to Park, when I read in the national press this mandate from the state down to local communities like we're seeing here, I've seen the same response in Florida, Maryland, so it's not a unique thing to Tina.
Well, it doesn't matter whether it's unique or not. She's adopting it, and I think that's the wrong policy to pursue when you cut citizenry out of it.
Well,
We're gonna have to get some legal help on this because they garbled the limited land use stuff. The provisions you're looking at are in the adjustment part of the bill. And then you move to the next section of the bill that deals with limited land use decisions, and they throw a section in you that says, the city shall apply the procedures in this section and only the procedures in this section to a limited land use decision, even if the city's not incorporated limited land use decisions into its land use regulations. You know, so, which is, because this section doesn't include the language that you can only send it to the applicant, the applicant's the only one who can appeal. So, which is, I don't know. You know, and they did change limited land use too, so that adds in non-conforming use reviews, which we're going to have to potentially adjust in terms of the process we use for them. All right, what I'm hearing is design standards, parking are your principal concerns with the palette. That you like the concept of not subsidizing these. Any other observations?
Try to find some way to incentivize the developers to use the ministerial process.
Okay.
Whatever that might involve, whether it be fees or whatever, or inadmissibility of the other programs, inapplicability.
Okay. And what do you think about trying to maximize the whatever cover we can get out of the shoreline designation?
Oh yeah,
for sure.
Okay.
Really thick pen.
If we incentivize folks to use the ministerial process, are we then, on the other side of the coin, are we then minimizing citizen input? And the whole thing is.
Well, there is no citizen input on the other. There is no citizen input on the process there.
Yeah, I think
the phone. Citizen input, I have to share that.
You will pardon?
On
the chance, everybody. It's the number one thing in the statewide planning goals. And yet, when it comes to selective things like this, they just blew it off.
Yeah, I see that as the lesser of two evils. Not a great way to go, but it's the best way to go given what we're presented here. Yeah.
Yes. But he's within sight.
That's right. We know where you live.
You also understand that what we're working with is within fairly tight constraints. It's not like we have a lot of leeway on this stuff. So, okay, that's the kind of feedback I needed. As I mentioned in the memo, Sherry's going to put together kind of verbatim transcript of the discussion. We'll provide that to the City Council for their meeting on the 18th so they have your thoughts in full. And we'll do our best to make sure it's all accurate. But,
thank you for the synopsis and the comparison.
That really good work.
I did read most of that fine print, but I kept falling asleep.
And again, we share that the city's policies are very clear. You guys have been very clear. The council's been very clear. The work we've been doing over more than a decade has all been geared to getting more housing out there. We share that objective. This is not, we want to thumb our nose at the governor's office because we don't care about housing. We care about housing big time. We've done a lot to try to move the dial, but a lot of time and effort's been put into making sure that's done in a way that works with our community and, our terrain and all the other things that make Newport. All right, the last item I had on the agenda, Bill, was just to confirm goals. This probably shouldn't take too long.
Because we're coming up on the magic hour.
Or you can make a motion on the goal piece.
Who can?
You can, if you're okay with it.
With the goals?
Yeah. Draft plan?
Yeah, I just had one question.
Oh, should I bring up the MS Word version, Bob?
No. I didn't find any typos.
Hey.
Whoa.
There's a bullet there about secure funding from the state of Oregon. Well, first of all, these are supposed to be planning commission goals, not community development goals.
Right.
Well, so
but they
I'm not going to be involved at all, and I don't think any of us, in securing funding.
No, but you can make that a priority for us. I mean, we work in tandem.
Well, I know that, but I just sort of thought the things that you actually do on a day-to-day basis should be in the department goals. And the stuff that...
Do you want to start that one with undertaking an economic opportunity analysis?
Pardon?
Do you want me to bring up the Word version, right, so I can tweak that?
No. I'm just making a comment that it's unclear where the distinction is between the commission goals and the department goals. So I'll just leave that. I'm not advocating to take it out. I'd love to work on securing funding, but I don't know how to do that. But if I can help, I'm glad.
I appreciate it, Bob. I think we work in tandem. There are things on this that are not necessarily department driven. I mean, I think I've had, initiate any needed refinements to the historic Night Beach design review overlay on there for a number of years now. That was not driven by the department. You guys wanted that on there because you always wanted to have a placeholder to address some of the concerns as they come up, as development happens down in Night Beach. And we have, I think you could throw, I wouldn't say it's an overlay issue so much, but the custom creative work fits within kind of the overall kind of...
I think Bob makes a good point, though. That's the one bullet that is probably the furthest away from the commission. So maybe it could say...
So I got somebody else voting for the Word version.
Supports the securing of funding.
It's good. I have the Word version right here. I can bring it up.
Oh, he wants to do it. I thought you were.
But before we go down that path, do we have anybody on Zoom or phone for the regular meeting?
No, we do not.
Okay.
The only substantive item really is the approval of this, right?
Right.
Yeah, so we kind of have to do this first.
Well, if you're going to look at the Word version, you could be here another 2 hours.
Yeah. We agree that's the one change you'd like to make.
That's all I have.
Watch this. How's that? Support securing funding from the state to undertake.
Hooray!
Okay, we can do that. I can put my full weight behind that.
I'll support that.
All right.
I think I don't know if I mentioned it, but there's a portion of the planning grant funding that the state has that is still reserved for economic opportunity analysis and the focus on the commercial and industrial side of the ledger and the need to promote healthy economies. It feels like it's been lost maybe for a little bit with this almost singular focus on housing, that we've had with the housing study, housing production strategy, and then the legislature's last couple, two or three sessions, it's been so heavily focused on housing, you kind of miss the rest of it, but it's still there.
That last quote there says updating city erosion control standards.
Yeah.
I don't think we have any, do we?
We do. They're in the building code, and they're adopted. They're actually Appendix J to the building code. It's adopted by reference through our municipal code. They're minimal.
Yeah, I mean, we've been talking about this for a lot of years, right? Erosion control.
Right, and stormwater. And we should do something here. The fear, I think the hesitancy on this has largely been staff resources to actually enforce it. That's the challenge. You know, if you know, we don't have somebody who can go out and check erosion control all the time. I mean, our building official is pretty busy just doing, you know, the palette of inspections that they're required to do. Public Works is forced to. So yeah, Public Works a little, yeah, quite a bit at this point. So.
Well, we could incorporate some of the erosion control issues into this landscaping. Does, you know, landscape 25% or no landscape requirements except for what's needed for erosion control, and have the developer actually submit an erosion control plan that might incorporate a 5-foot strip of grass in the front, something to control runoff from a development, since they don't have the landscape.
Yeah, there's some things we can do on that front for water quality and addressing erosion control and that. And as you know, we've got a standard on the books for a design storm of, you know, it's a 25-year, 24-hour duration storm, but we don't provide any direction on how that's to be implemented. We probably should at some point. You know, under what circumstances will we allow housing to connect to existing structured piped drainage systems? Right now, our general approach is, if our stormwater master plan didn't identify an issue with the capacity of that particular basin, we'll allow the connection. If it did identify a capacity issue that's proximate to where that connection is proposed, then we won't allow the connection, that kind of thing. But we could be more explicit in the rules.
Does the water in the storm system, is it anywhere near capacity at this point? I've heard rumors among some folks that pushing up against the capacity of the system.
I don't know whether that's
okay. The wastewater, we have a draft, which you'll eventually be seeing, a draft wastewater master plan for the wastewater plant, which is the second part two of the wastewater master plans. And that plan acknowledges that we are pushing the bar on flow through in the winter months during heavy storms. And that's because of stormwater infiltration into the pipes. It is nothing to do with new housing development or new development generally. It's stormwater infiltration.
Antiquated system.
Right.
It leaks.
Right. Old pipes.
They leak.
The cracks. They leak.
Intrusion.
And you know, while we've done a lot to try to mitigate that, and we'll continue to work on that, that's going to be an ongoing problem. But more to follow on the stormwater master plan. That will come to you here as soon as Brown and Caldwell gets the last pieces of that they're required to put into it, that they haven't done yet, which is addressing DEQ requirements so that we can actually have a facility plan that we can use to support getting loans from the state to begin to chip away at what that plan will call for, which is $80 million in improvements over the life of the plan. That's a big, big bar. That's why we have people in D.C. right now trying to lobby at the federal level to get us federal funding.
Is that an expansion of capacity that will handle the population growth that we're told to expect in the next 20 years, or is this a short term?
The plan includes future expansion to address growth needs. The bulk of that cost, though, has to do with a fact that we have an old wastewater treatment plant and it needs to be fully modernized. Yeah. And so the bulk of the cost has nothing to do with growth and everything to do with the age of the existing facility. And as you modernize, you're bringing it up to current standards. And so some of the methods and equipment and all that gets all swapped out too. All right, I made the one change. I got to bust out the MS Word version. So
did you need a motion on these goals?
Yeah. Yeah, if you could. If that's
at the regular meeting,
correct.
Okay.
We just finalized them now.
Okay, the last thing on here is the PC work program.
Made a couple of changes there. The signed variance application came in, and so April 8th is a good date. You're going to have a public hearing on the signed variance for Harbor Freight. I'm meeting tomorrow with Meg Reed. You've met her before. She's DLCD's lead person on the estuary management plan. She has kind of the dates that are in here. We're going to go through that. You had some materials from Mr. Arnold that he wants to, you know, you to take a look at and keep on your radar. We will ensure that Mr. Arnold and others are invited to the table once we actually are holding these meetings and starting to work through the materials. Part of this has been trying to sync up with Meg in terms of where she's at, because we do need DLCD to have an active voice as part of this implementation. We're not the only jurisdiction in our county that has to implement. We're implementing, Lincoln County has to implement, Toledo has to implement, so on and so forth. And they're trying to make sure everything is as consistent as we can make it, recognizing we deal with slightly different issues in the developed part of the estuary than, say, Lincoln County does in some of the more rural areas. That's all I have on that.
Ask a quick question. Did Newport get its $875,000 in that other?
No, we did not. It got cut out at the last second. So that was the Howe bill. And that went from 21 million in projects to 7 million in projects, like at the 11th hour. It was, you know, it had already cleared initial committee work. This was done in the joint. This was the joint committee finishing touches on hitting a budget bar. And yeah, 2/3 of the projects, including ours, got kicked out of that bill. I've talked to the developer on that. I think our view is we'll go after it again at the full session for 2025. And again coordinate with Representative Gomberg and remind him it didn't make the cut last time, so our turn this time.
Yeah.
He's been a very good advocate for the city, but not all of the projects that you know fall within his district will make the cut every year.
On that estuary management work session discussion, I've been in touch with Annie Merrill.
Yeah, and she's reached out to me.
Right. Is she welcome to attend?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Once we actually hold work sessions, and I know it's actually going to be something that's doable and we'll have, you know, DLCD here. Yeah, absolutely.
Well, that's next meeting, isn't it?
That's the plan. I'm meeting with Meg Reed tomorrow, and unless alarm bells fly on her end that's somehow problematic, we'll stick to it. So. And then I'll let Ann know, because she and I are actually on a different estuary planning work group. So,
of course,
I know. Yeah,
got to be more.
There's no end into it. Yeah.
Anything else about anybody? Bob?
No, I'm ready to move on.
Work session is now terminated. And we give Sherry a minute to...